interpreting the history of philosophy, mainly the type of philosophy that has been inspired by Hegel, also he wrote on Adorno, also on Marx. He told me yesterday, and I could only pale of envy, that he read all the three volumes of Marx Capital. I must confess that after the first I stopped. But he inflicted the pain on himself to read the whole three volumes, because he thought if you write a book on Marx, you have to read all three of them, which is a very reasonable maxim. But I hope it will be purgatory deductible, the time that you spend in Marx Capital. In any case, we are very happy to have you here. And I want to greet Christian Cristofolini and Julian Locke, who are his students who are traveling with him through America. I also want to greet Eric, whom you all know because he has been already several times with us as a PhD student from the literature program. And I want to mention that our friend and co-fellow, Martin Blumer, became father last week, not physically, but spiritually. His fourth book his fourth book came out. It is not the book that he wrote here, that would be too quick, just joined us in January, but it is a book on the School of Rome, and it's I've only had a chance to look at it yesterday evening, a very thorough analysis of the formation of a specific Roman ideal of education. How was schooling in Rome done? I think it will stand with Maru and the other classics on the history of education. So congratulations to our friend Martin for this book that just came out. And now, without further ado, Giacomo, we are...
So Dr. Cristofoletti will give a very little address to the audience and also present you a gift that
very good.
To the Institute.
Thank you very much.
Questo qua, il pergamena. È fatta da un artigiano a mano.
Ah, un artigiano a mano, molto bello. Ah, molto bene.
La fate incorniciare.
Molto bello.
Sono gli stessi pergamene che fanno i diplomi di laurea.
Bello, molto bello. The University of Urbino, which thanks us, Giacomo, Christian, and Julian, thanks for the hospitality at the Institute for Advanced Study. Thank you so much.
Wonderful.
It's very beautiful.
That's great.
The old Italian art. Thank you so much.
Cosa facciamo? C'è introduzione? O aspettano di finire di mangiare?
No, no, si comincia adesso.
Si comincia?
Sì.
Ok. Good morning, everybody. First of all, on behalf of our delegation and of the University of Urbino, I would like to thank the Chancellor of the University of Notre Dame, the Director of the Institute for Advanced Study, Professor Donald Staluto, and of course, Professor Vittorio Oesle, who has made this event possible. I would also like to thank you all for coming. The idea for the journey that brings us here today, this prestigious university, was born some time ago, inspired in particular by the three-day international congress, Hegel's Thought in the Age of Globalization, which took place at the University of Urbino in early June 2010. The Congress was attended by numerous illustrious Hegelian scholars from several major countries of the Western world who gave informed and demanding talks appreciated by colleagues and public alike. I had a strong wish to be present at today's event because I believe in the importance of the exchange of ideas and of interplay of dynamic trains of thought regarding Hegel and idealism, particularly between sister societies separated for more than two centuries by the Atlantic Ocean. In that which has come to be defined by almost everybody as the age of globalization, it is precisely the observation of current events that make us understand the disparate need for rules of synthesis. A philosophy in general is valid on the basis of the coherent responses that it is able to produce. Now, in our present, every input is oriented toward the future. Which philosophy, if not idealist philosophy, can stimulate adequate and, above all, rapid feedback? It is perhaps the only philosophy that enables us to decipher in a consistent manner the stimuli coming from our environmental, allowing us to make reliable predictions. The societal bond in the Western countries has traditionally been Christianity, but with the coming of secularization, of a multiculturalism, of the internet. In short, with the coming of globalization, the religious community is in gradual dissolution. The hope we may have is to supplement, if not substitute, to modern religious community with a global philosophical community, the generally idealist offspring of the philosophy of spirit, a philosophy of globalization, able to overcome the political, social, and religious conflicts that afflict humanity. Through an eternal process realized in time, in history, eventually eliminating the major conflicts. I'm pleased to be able to present at this prestigious university and to this public that today honors us with his presence, the philosophical personality of the speaker you will very soon hear, Professor Giacomo Rinaldi of the University of Bino. Professor Rinaldi's interest in the philosophy of Hegel began right at the beginning of his scientific career. It is an interest which, while never having been of a merely philosophical or academic nature, has always been characterized by a profound theoretical preoccupation. He sees in Hegel the highest representation of European idealism and has learned from the German philosopher the fundamental lesson that even if in the historical development of philosophical thought, idealism appears to constitute only a particular tendency, simply destined today to become ever more marginal, it is in reality the driving force of every philosophy. This is because idealism is the attempt to give a rational response of means of logical, cogent, and universally shareable reasoning to the fundamental problems of knowledge. And the key to such a response may be summed up in brief and in the famous Hegelian pronouncement: the only true and absolute reality is the spirit. The talk that Professor Rinaldi will give today, however, does not concern directly the thought of Hegel, but rather that of the foremost Italian philosopher of the 20th century, Giovanni Gentile. In his talk, the professor will attempt to give an articulate and plausible response to a question posed to him by our colleague Professor Stelluto. Why does actualism, that is the philosophy of Gentile, remain a legitimate philosophical position even today? But the divergence between the content of the present talk on the one hand and the basic theoretical and historiographical interest of Professor Rinaldi on the other is in fact more apparent than real, because as many of you will know, Gentile's philosophy was basically an attempt to formulate a new, more radical form of idealism in the light of a reform of the Hegelian dialectic. It at distinguishing an Hegel's system that which is dead from that which is living. This, of course, is the title of a famous essay on Hegel by Benedetto Croce, but the critical approach in it can hold good also for Gentile's interpretation of Hegel philosophy. Rinaldi will seek, in essence, to point out the merits, but also the limits of Gentile's philosophical perspective and of its critical comparison to the thought of the great philosopher of Stuttgart. Having already had the opportunity to read the Italian version of today's talk, I can assure you that the considerations put forward by Professor Rinaldi are without doubt original, illuminating, and above all, based on an accurate knowledge of the text of Gentile. For all these reasons, I hope that you will find this talk as interesting and stimulating as did. I hope too that this gathering will be a semi-opportunity for fruitful collaboration between the University of Notre Dame and the University of Urbino. Thank you all for listening. La parola.
Well, the paper is a bit longer than is usual in this institute, and as a consequence, I shall read only sections 1 and 2 in agreement with the proposal by Professor.
It's 1 o'clock, I must cut you the word. At 1 o'clock we stop, then we will have time for a discussion.
Well, no proposal could have been more welcome than the invitation made to me by two colleagues of this prestigious university, Professor Vittorio Hösle and Professor Donald Sterluto, to speak before a qualified philosophical audience, such as the present one certainly is, about Giovanni Gentile's philosophy, and in particular to answer the question, why is actual idealism still today a legitimate philosophical position? Gentile was undoubtedly the greatest Italian philosopher in the 20th century, for no one more than him succeeded in joining the most concentrated theoretical interest for absolute truth with the most careful and detailed historiographic analysis of the individual personalities and determinate doctrines in and through which the idea of truth achieves objective reality, concrete manifestation, and formative influence on human culture's historical development. On the other hand, openly setting himself against the whole theological and metaphysical tradition of antiquity and the Middle Ages, Gentile emphatically denies that theoretical knowledge of truth can be conceived as the passive contemplation of an idea or real object being already given and therefore presupposed to the act of its knowledge by human self-consciousness, and thus indifferent to its essence and process. From Kant's epistemology and Vico's famous principle of the verum factum, in fact, he derived the idea that knowing, if considered as to its transcendental originality, is rather a, quote, constructive activity of experience, which is in the last resort identical with the creativity of the will. Modern philosophy as idealism, he therefore concludes, is essentially an ethics, end quote. The moral problem thus achieves an unconditional, decisive primacy in actualism, as Gentile's actual idealism is also usually named, which offers it an articulated and convincing solution, doing justice both to its immediate juridical and economic conditions, the so-called wanted will, volere voluto, and to the no less necessary autonomy and self-determination of the actual will, volere in atto, which fully realizes itself only in the ethicality of the state. Sharply polemizing both against the theocratic conceptions of politics, which were privileged by Christian medieval theology, and against the liberal individualism of modernity, as well as the materialistic socialism of the contemporary age, Gentile theoretically works out and testifies, even to the point of sacrificing his own life, the ideal of an ethical state being like, not because it should be atheistic or agnostic, but because it has in itself, without any need for a transcendent investiture, the substantiality of the divine, or rather, is the only adequate manifestation of the will's inner religiosity. On the other hand, the peculiar universality of the ethical ideal in principle excludes the possibility that it be fully actualized by the contingent and arbitrary, inevitably powerless will of an isolated individual. Against the moral and social atomism holding sway over modern society since the age of the Enlightenment, Gentile vindicates with ever eloquent and mostly felicitous expressions the intrinsic sociality of the moral world. The fundamental error of individualistic liberalism, he points out, consists in the fact that it, quote, disown any ethical substance and any effective reality to the state, a state community which individuals find in their most profound inwardness, and which is the inner root of their own personality and right. The state, he continues, is not inter homines, but in interiore homine. It is not that which we see above us, but that which we realize within us by our work of all days and all instants. All of us realize today that in the past we overly extolled the strength, the value, and the right of individuality, of abstract subjectivity. For within our individual subjective reality, such as we succeed in knowing it by living it, we hear something speaking which overcomes the individual and limits the subject. End quote. Finally, the fundamental error of Marxist socialism, against which he rightly polemized with full cognition of the case since 1899, the year in which he published his second book, La Filosofia di Marx, is that of misunderstanding in a materialistic sense that concept of the overturning of praxis, prassi rovesciata, namely of the dialectical development of the act of the will, which, since Hegel, constitutes one of the most crucial achievements of contemporary philosophy. By presupposing to man's praxis the transcendent reality of matter, Marxism falls back on the one hand into the epistemological naivety of dogmatic realism, thus showing itself to have learned nothing at all from Kant's critique of knowledge, and it loses sight, on the other, of the inner spiritual character of man's activity, insofar as it unduly privileges outer manual work. In the state's absolute ethicality and in its adequate, immanent self-consciousness in philosophical knowing, then, the original, absolute identity of thought and the will fully actualizes and celebrates itself. It therefore constitutes as such the absolute concreteness of the act of thinking, or, as Gentile himself also puts it, of spirit's pure act, atto puro. But just as there is no truth without error, no good without evil, no object without subject, so spirit's concreteness too is possible and thinkable only as a unity or mediation of two opposite abstract moments. As it essentially constitutes itself as the identity of subject, that is inwardness, activity, and object, that is universality, absoluteness, the abstract moments, ideally, not temporarily, preceding it, will respectively be that of positing spirit's abstract subjectivity, which expresses itself in the world of art, and that of the opposite positing of its abstract objectivity, which lies at the root of the spiritual form of religion. Gentile's actualism, then, not unlike Hegel's philosophy, culminates in the systematic explication of the absolute forms of spirit, art, religion, and philosophy. his book, La Filosofia dell'Arte, 1931, his preceding Discorsi di Religione, 1920, and the two volumes of his Sistema di Logica come Teoria del Conoscere, 1917, 1921, must certainly be counted among the undisputed masterpieces of 20th century philosophy. At this point, I can already give a first provisional answer to the question posed. What I have so far summarily hinted at does suffice, I think, to realize the broadness and systematic vigor of actual idealism, its extraordinary capacity to conflate into an organic, coherent whole the most heterogeneous forms and conceptions in which spirit's activity realizes and manifests itself. If we take into consideration the greatest systems worked out by Western philosophy, only in the case of those of Kant and of Hegel does the comparison turn to the disadvantage of actualism. This is because Gentile did not work out any philosophy of nature and of the natural sciences. On the contrary, he even peremptorily denied in principle its possibility. If the peculiar theoretical purpose of a philosophical idealism is the full resolution of nature into spirit, then any possible philosophy of nature would, so he argues, lose any plausible reason for existence. Concerning this, however, one could easily object that the idealistic denial of nature's absolute concreteness by no means excludes, indeed, it necessarily implies, the admission of the fact that the logical idea can and must actualize itself also in an immediate, abstractly objective form, which as such is something other than concrete self-consciousness, and thus coincides with the very special temporal manifoldness of natural phenomena and processes. It is one thing, then, to negate nature's absolute reality, and quite another to negate that it could nevertheless constitute the legitimate subject matter of a specific philosophical science. Although admitting, then, that actualism leaves the metaphysical problem of nature, as well as that of its knowledge, unsolved, one cannot deny that truth's self-consciousness in the absolute forms of art, religion, and philosophy comes in it to a degree of development that for systematic richness was by no means matched in 20th century philosophy. If it is true, therefore, as Hegel proved once and for all, that true philosophy can be carried out only in the form of a system, then the genuinely systematic character of actualism by itself constitutes a cogent argument for vindicating its up-to-dateness even nowadays. The systematic exigency essentially inherent in philosophical thought, however, can be satisfied as the history of philosophy in the 20th century has widely shown in very different ways, moving between two opposite extremes. For the unity of the manifold concepts, categories, and theories of which the system necessarily consists can be conceived either as a subjective unity of knowing, whose manifold objects are presupposed as inherently heterogeneous and mutually indifferent, or as the immanent differentiation of an original unity which posits the manifold only in order then to sublate or reassume it into itself. The most emblematic example of the first alternative is probably Nicolai Hartmann's systematic philosophy, according to which the system of the philosophical sciences would be nothing other than the necessarily incomplete aggregate of a multiplicity of cognitions concerning entities, categories, or ontological strata, Seinsschichten, subsisting in themselves before and independently of their unification into the system. If systematic philosophy is thus conceived, it plainly falls, on the one hand, into the insoluble antinomies which, as Plato had already admirably shown in his Parmenides, ineluctably infect any pluralistic metaphysics starting from the assumption that many are. Parmenides 164a, 165e. On the other, it could hardly avoid turning into a sort of superficial eclecticism, into the external arbitrary synthesis of a knowing already produced by others and thus lacking any genuine originality. Gentile's actualism, by contrast, is the most radical realization known to me of the opposite alternative. Man's whole knowledge, or indeed the whole of reality, which for him is ultimately coincidental with such knowledge, would in fact be nothing other than the manifestation of a unique absolute principle, the idea as the act of thinking, atto del pensare, or thinking thought, pensiero pensante, or the concrete logos, logo concreto, substantially equivalent expressions which, in the last analysis, do not mean anything other than the true idea, unlike that of Plato, is no abstract, transcendent object, but is rather the dynamical, immanent unity of subject and object. Gentile, therefore, did not once hesitate explicitly to define actual idealism as a spiritualistic monism, monismo spiritualistico. The whole theoretical construction of his philosophy consequently stands or falls depending on whether the principle on which it is based is held to be true or false. This monistic orientation of philosophical knowing was already present and active in Hegel's system, but is even more emphasized, if possible, by actualism. As we shall shortly see, one of the essential differences between Gentile's version of philosophical idealism and the Hegelian one lies just in the fact that, whereas for Hegel the self-differentiation of the principle of the system, that is, its development, is no less important than the principle itself, for Gentile the solution of philosophy's unique eternal problem seems to turn exhaustively into the adequate statement and defense of such a principle. According to a pregnant formulation to be found in his Discorsi di Religione, actual idealism fundamental assumption would consist in the thesis that, quote, that reality which is our reality is but idea, that idea in which indeed any most material reality is idealized in as much as it is thought of by us, end quote. In order to clarify the real meaning of this definition by Gentile, one could observe that the reality which is the object of any possible knowledge or action is of necessity our reality. For about a reality external or transcendent to our experience and knowledge, we could not, strictly speaking, affirm anything at all in a consistent way, not even the factum brutum of its mere existence. But Gentile, unlike the psychological empiricists of modernity and the various kinds of relativists holding sway over the contemporary age, is fully aware that the we, whose being we can apodeictically affirm, is by no means the object of immanent perception or of inner sense, which is inevitably mutable and transitory, and as originally passive, dependent upon another that is, strictly speaking, unknowable, but only the ideal logical identity of the I quay I think, or just the act of thinking. But thinking, for Gentile, just as for Kant, is essentially judging. And judgment is the subsumption of the particular under the universality of the category, the pure concept, the idea. This is why the idea is the original condition for the possibility of any knowing, willing, or acting whatsoever, and why true philosophy, which for Gentile, just as for Plato and Hegel, is the highest form of such knowing, is always and of necessity idealism. But if it is true that the principle of any true philosophy is idealism, it is also true that it is not realized in an equally adequate way in all the philosophical systems that are historically given. In fact, one of actual idealism's most peculiar and audacious tenets is just its peremptory refusal to recognize the adequacy of the realization of the principle of idealism in all the philosophies different from actualism, including, as we shall see, even Hegel's philosophy. Against Platonic Aristotelian metaphysics, Gentile raises the objection, which is ultimately plausible, that although it has the merit of identifying actual reality with the idea, the form, or the thought of thought, it yet conceives of these concepts as objects that are already given and thus presupposed to the self-conscious act of thinking through which the eye becomes aware of them. For the same reason for which any reality external to human self-consciousness is in itself impossible and unthinkable, Platonic Aristotelian idealism would be unable consistently to ground its own principle. The second fundamental form of idealism is identified by Gentile in Christianity, insofar as it, in polemic against both Greek naturalism and Jewish transcendent theism, extols the absolute reality and the truth of spirit. Yet, not even in Christianity does the principle of idealism succeed in coming to adequate manifestation and self-consciousness, because its vindication of spirit's absolute reality continues to be grounded in a dualistic conception of reality, in which the I's infinity, although recognized by it, is nevertheless contradictorily negated, in that it presupposes to the infinite I the independent reality of nature and of a transcendent personal God, who, as transcendent, Gentile acutely remarks, does not actually distinguish himself from nature except for the anthropomorphic predicates religious representation unsuitably ascribes to him. The limit of a modern idealism is instead its abstract subjectivism. For Berkeley, the esse of the material object is in truth nothing other than its perception or idea in man's finite mind, in the empirical eye. But this latter, as such, still presupposes outside itself, as the ultimate foundation of its reality, the infinite mind of that personal omniscient God, who for Gentile is actually impossible and unthinkable, insofar as his alleged infinity is contradictorily negated by the positive of man's finite mind outside him. Kant does distinguish from the empirical I, which is the object of inner sense, the transcendental I, or the I think in general, as original perception or universal self-consciousness, and he does attribute to the transcendental I and not to the empirical I the function of constituting experience's objective unity. But the universality of the transcendental I is merely empty and formal, and therefore is unable absolutely to posit the actual content of knowing, which therefore must be derived from the passive datum of empirical intuition. This latter, on the other hand, is explained by Kant as the effect of the causality of the thing in itself, or of the noumenon on the sensible faculty of the eye, thus once again contradictorily presupposing the reality of an object external to self-consciousness. The full-fledged purification of the principle of idealism from any residue of transcendence infecting all its versions so far worked out would instead be programmatically carried out by actual idealism, which is therefore presented by its author as the truth of Western philosophy's whole historical development. According to this new position of thought, absolute reality comes to be identified without residue with the thinking activity of the transcendental I, and any possible object of our consciousness therefore turns in the end into an immanent content generated by it in the process of its self-reflection. Actual idealism thus presents itself as a radical form of absolute immanentism, and its peculiar method is the method of immanence, which Gentile effectively describes as follows, quote, "The method of immanence then consists in the conception of reality's absolute concreteness in the act of thinking or in history. This act is unduly transcended when one begins positing something, God, nature, logical law, moral law, historical reality as a set of facts, spiritual or psychical categories beyond consciousness's actuality, that is not the very I as self-positive, or as Kant says, the I think," end quote. Gentile's rigorous adherence to the method of immanence enables him to unfold with admirable consistency all the most relevant epistemological, metaphysical, and ethical implications contained in the principle of actualism. The limited time at my disposal allows me to mention only the most original and significant ones. The absolute identity of epistemology and metaphysics, his conception of the act of thinking as pure act or self-grounding, autoktisi, and finally, his theory of the relation between religion and philosophy. The self-consciousness into which actual idealism resolves any possible object or content of our experience is not, as I have said, unlike Kant's transcendental I, a merely formal and finite function of our knowing. For, according to Gentile, in the process of actual thought, not only our subjective representation of reality, but also its very objective essence and existence come to be constituted. Thus, it can brilliantly overcome the traditional contraposition between the viewpoint of ancient and medieval philosophy, which unanimously subordinated epistemology to metaphysics. Archicotate de ton epistemon, the queen of sciences, according to Aristotle's well-known definition, and that of modern philosophy, which instead confined its own subject matter to the epistemological analysis of the conditions for the possibility of experience, and denied in principle the possibility of metaphysics. Insofar as the process of our knowing coincides with the process of absolute reality, epistemology turns out to be, in the last resort, identical with metaphysics itself, and thus actual idealism, although rejecting, in accordance with modern philosophy, the traditional metaphysics of being, yet posits at the same time the more solid foundations of a new metaphysics of subjectivity, or, to use a pregnant expression coined by the Hegelian philosopher Bertrando Spaventa, a metaphysics of mind, metaphysica della mente. Kant's error Gentile acutely points out was that he did not see, quote, that his epistemology was no critique, but a doctrine of pure reason. It was not a preface to metaphysics, but metaphysics itself. For only insofar as knowledge is the very process of reality, can knowing be necessary and universal, and the activity unfolding in it be truly a priori, that is, free. Idealism was not to be understood as a limitation, but as a higher interpretation, transvalutazione, of the absolute totality of the real, end quote. Unlike a good deal of ancient, modern, and also contemporary philosophy, Gentile clearly understands that self-consciousness, reality, is no immediate being, no substance, no natural or ideal presupposition of the act of our thinking, but rather the product, the absolute result of our immanent, free, spontaneous activity. As already for Fichte, a philosopher far more akin to Gentile than the latter's works would suggest, so for him too, self-consciousness, spirit, the I, is only insofar as it posits itself, and to designate this immanent, absolute self-creation of spiritual reality, he coins the technical term of autoktisi. The act of spirit then logically precedes its immediate being. This latter, consequently, is immediate only for itself, but not in itself. In other words, it seems to be immediate, but in reality it is not such. For its seeming immediacy is nothing other than the result of the I's self-analysis, auto-analysis, splitting up the absolute unity of subject and object into the abstract subjectivity of the immediate I, sense, natural will, particular and egoistic interests, and the correlative abstract objectivity of nature. All of a transcendent object, God, moral law, the abstract logos. The positive contradiction issuing from the negation of original identity then is for Gentile, as it already was for Hegel, the fundamental law of the act of thinking, of the concrete logos. Quote, that identity of A and not A, which the logic of the abstract, that is formal logic, rejected as a contradiction, is instead the immanent law of the concrete logic. Contradiction, far from being the death of thought, such as it appeared in the logic of the abstract, here turns out to be the life of thought, end quote. Yet, unlike contemporary irrationalists such as Adorno or Hartmann, Gentile clearly understands that a contradiction destined to remain unsolved is no less impossible and unthinkable than empty analytic identity, and that consequently the I's self-analysis must necessarily be followed by its self-synthesis, autosynthesis, by which the original unity of subject and object is reintegrated in a mediated and concrete form. The ethico-political consequences of this conception of the essence of the human spirit are of the utmost relevance. By conceiving the I's immediate being, namely man as a natural individual and will, to be a mere contradictory abstraction to be negated within the universality of the subject-object, it peremptorily rejects all those utilitarian, naturalistic, materialistic conceptions of man, which, since the age of the Enlightenment, identify the ultimate aim of human existence with the search for individual happiness or success, that is, with the egoistic satisfaction of his natural needs. The true I, man's perfect humanity, Gentile insists, is not, that is not naturally given, but makes itself, and it can make itself only by sacrificing, if necessary, life itself to the fulfillment of duty, that is, of the ethical ideal. The realization of self-consciousness, self-synthesis, he solemnly affirms, quote, is in the determinacy of its dialectic the whole content of morals. And therefore, all moral doctrines appeal to the idea as the negation of natural egoism, as a sacrifice of the particular individuality by which each man eternally begins from the differences distinguishes him from others. I stop here, but there are other things to say, but I comply to the invitation by Professor Rose.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, our speakers list so far is Carl and Vittorio on it. Carl?
Thank you very much. That's very informative. I read ahead to your interesting critique of Gentili's political views and so forth. This sounds to me, I've always been curious about Gentili, sounds to me a little bit like an Italian version of Rorty, with a kind of Hegelian holism, and then instead of European politics, one could imagine a American version of this, but with both of those thinkers, I'm always curious about what they think about art. So you didn't get to that, but some of my friends have always thought Gentile has a very valuable philosophy of art, and I don't really see how modern art can be easily incorporated in systematic philosophy. And I wonder if there are parts of his philosophy of art that you might just point us to, or if you think he has valuable things to say about art, especially in its modern form.
Yes. I was unable to present to you Gentile's philosophy of art for the simple reason that, as you see, the time is very limited. But I can say that his major book on the philosophy of art, La Filosofia dell'Arte, which was published in 1931, is undoubtedly one of the masterpieces of Italian aesthetic thought in the 20th century. The importance of this book is not so much to enter into discussion of stylistic trends, art forms, or to develop a critic of literature, art, music, and so on. The problem is quite different. This is a metaphysical art. It is a problem of deducing the transcendental form of art as the expression of the abstract subjectivity of spirit from the total system of spirit's reality. This is a metaphysical approach. Secondly, there is also a strong critical approach that is directed all against another famous aesthetics that in Italy got even 21 editions, that is Benedetto Croce's aesthetic as a science of expression and as general linguistic. And I think the main objective of this book by Gentile was just to show all the shortcomings of this Crocian aesthetic. Croce himself was far more interested in the literary criticism, and he says explicitly in his contribution to the critic of myself of 1915 that his aesthetic was born just by his experience with the history of art. It is all devoted to the treatment of particular aesthetic problems. Gentile's critic is just directed against this approach. He says there are not many particular problems in philosophy, there are not many particular styles, problems in aesthetic, but there is only one problem that expresses itself quite differently. And thus, the fundamental mistake of Croce's aesthetic, as pointed out in La Filosofia dell'Arte, is that of empiricism. And Gentile speaks quite overtly of the pseudo-idealism of an empiricist aesthetics, just meaning Croce aesthetic, upon which he expresses a quite negative, disparaging judgment. He says, Croce is the new Voltaire. It's the new Voltaire. He's very brilliant, very interesting. He write in a way that most people like it, but it's no true philosophy because it is constitutionally unable to posit and solve the problem of the absolute. So Gentile's philosophy of art is the philosophical doctrine in which he tries to explain how the absolute as absolute spirit must and can and must express itself within that subjective form of spirit which is just the essence of art. And a third important aspect of this book by Gentile is the evaluation of pure feeling as the original root of spirit development. One finds just this doctrine in other systematic works by Gentile, and he identifies the essence of a pure feeling just with the essence of art. He says, Croce is wrong when he says that art is the contemplation of feeling. Art is pure feeling. And this is one way in which he tries to deduce the necessity of art. Just as also Hegel said in his philosophy of spirit, just as spirit's development starts from an immediate form, that is feeling, Gefühl, so art is the first primordial, original form of spirit development, just because art is feeling. And this theory of a pure feeling is one of the most significant theoretical achievements of his philosophy of art. And the last important aspect of this work by Gentile is that he, just in the aftermath of Hegel, refuses the Kantian concept of art as a pure form. In art, there is form. Form is just a pure feeling. But this form must penetrate a content, and this content is always thought. Thought is the content of art. Art is the expression in the form of pure feeling of that thought content that expresses itself in a more adequate way in philosophy. And thus the conclusion of Gentile's aesthetic is that art is only an inactual form of spirit. Spirit does not achieve its own real actuality in art, but only in philosophy and ethics. And this is, in my opinion, a new version of Hegel's conception of the death of art. I hope this will be sufficient in the limited time at my disposal.
Vittorio?
Giacomo, thank you very much for a great introduction to Gentile. Let me ask three questions. The first one is the question with which you struggle in the third part of your paper. For those of you who are not so familiar with Gentile, Gentile was not only important Italian philosopher, but he was the leading public intellectual of Italian fascism.
Yes.
He was a minister of education under Mussolini. He changed the university and the school system, and fundamentally the way how the Italian schools and universities function till today was created by Gentile. And the problem, of course, is that we have here, on the one hand, a public intellectual who is certainly a very talented philosopher who enters into politics, shapes history, but makes a quite massive blunder, because not only he embraces Italian fascism, but in 1943, when the king deposes Mussolini, he leaves the southern part of Italy, which soon will become controlled by the Allies, and flees to the north, declaring his loyalty to the Duce. And is then shot by Italian partisans in 1944. And Croce, who I agree with Giacomo Rinaldi, was not a very sharp philosopher, was an impeccable defender of classical liberalism, therefore was suppressed under Italian fascism, and the break between Gentile and Croce had exactly to do with that. And the problem, of course, that we have when we deal with these great public intellectuals, we have in Germany the same problem with Heidegger, who, as you also know, became rector under Hitler and wanted to lead the Führerführung, to lead the Führer, etc., etc. And all this became a little bit embarrassing. So the whole point I'm trying to make is, how do you think that the credibility of the Gentilian project has suffered from the fact that on his commitment to a strong idea of a state, to which, with which myself I have sympathies, because I do not think that a state can function if everyone tries to maximize his own profit. It cannot work. You need a class of dedicated public officials that think more than how they can become rich. General corruption doesn't make general welfare. So all this is right, but at the same time, he was not able to understand the valid, necessary principles of political liberalism of British Anglo-American extraction, and therefore he embraced Mussolini. So my question is, do you think that there's any connection, some thought in his theoretical philosophy that explains why he then embraced Italian fascism? And I want to recognize, I hope you know me enough to not believe that I'm a fascist, but it is true that when Mussolini came to power, most Italians were in favor of that. It was only very intelligent people like Croce, who from the beginning understood this is going into disaster. But there was an enormous popular support for Mussolini. So Gentile, in many aspects, was not an isolated person, but was doing what most Italians are doing at that time. The second question, I will reduce this to the second question, I've already spoken too long, is the problem of how does Gentile relate to contemporary European philosophy. Even if he was a proud Italian nationalist, as you say at the end, and has great merits in having reconstructed the great Italian philosophical tradition, beginning with Bruno Campanella to Vico, was an excellent historian of philosophy. When you read what he says about immanentism, you immediately say, but that's Husserl, because the central idea of Husserl's transcendental phenomenology is exactly this, that there can be no noemata, no objects of thought, without a noesis, an act of thought relating to that. It's fundamentally the Husserlian program. I like very much what you're saying, that he's in fact closer to Fichte than to Hegel. I think you're completely right. The lack of philosophy of nature is an example that he's closer to Fichte. But how does he relate to Husserl? And what you were saying now about pure feeling is, of course, Cohen's aesthetics. I mean, the Neo-Kantian idea of a pure aesthetics against which Gadamer then revolted is based on the idea that as there's a pure will, a pure thought, there's also pure feeling, and that aesthetics is based on pure feelings. So how did he react to Cohen, who, of course, was Jewish? And I want to mention this to the honor of Gentile. Gentile was never an anti-Semite, and he protected Jews at personal risk.
Yes.
So he was not...
Richard Kroner.
Exactly. For example, he protected several Jews at high personal risk. So he was not personally a monster. This is important, I think, to recognize when you deal with this very complex character.
Well, these are three very relevant questions, and I can answer the first by pointing out that in the third section of my paper, I myself felt the need to try to explain if and to what extent there is a root in his actual idealism of his subsequent political options that were very relevant both in himself as and for his destiny. His destiny is very life. This the problem is quite complex. One should carefully read his book, his Hegel book, La Riforma della Dialettica Hegeliana, in order to understand where start that theoretical trend that led him to embrace unconditionally, unqualifiedly, the fascistic doctrine. I try to summarize my interpretation of this theoretical nexus. As far as actual idealism itself, as I have tried to present it in the part of my paper that I have read is concerned, I must deny that there is any close link between this idealistic conception of reality and knowledge and fascism. On the contrary, Gentile emphasis, both from the epistemological and from the ethical viewpoint, is on the absolute freedom of the human spirit. There is the cult of freedom, freedom just intended, construed in the Kantian, Fichtean once more, way as transcendental freedom and the self-determination of an autonomous practical reason. This is just the root of all his actual idealism, and from this viewpoint, there is no connection with fascism at all, with no authoritarian conception, both of religion and of politics. This is also the gist of his conception of religion. I unfortunately was unable to read what I have tried to say about this. But Gentile, in my opinion, follows more the left wing of the Hegelian school on this subject. For instance, Bruno Bauer, David Friedrich Strauss, then the Hegelian right. And although he acknowledges the ontological necessity of religion, is strongly critical of the authoritarian aspect that is unavoidably implicit in the religious conception, insofar as it identifies reality with an abstract transcendent object. And from this viewpoint, my reply is there are absolutely no connection between actual idealism in itself and an authoritarian conception of a political life, such as fascism. The link between these two aspects of his production and his thought, in my opinion, this is my interpretation, is to be sought for in another aspect of his philosophical conception. This is just his reform of Hegelian dialectic. Why is Gentile so critical of Hegel? In some context, it seems that he, Gentile, is the very idealist. In Hegel, there are residues of realism and transcendence. First of all, the philosophy of nature, but many other aspects of the Hegelian system that I cannot try to explain to you in detail, but in my book on Gentile, I have tried to clarify all this problem. What is the gist, the fundamental idea and the result at the same time of his critique of Hegelian dialectic? Is the idea that the pure concept, the act of thought, is in itself undifferentiated and cannot be objectivized. That is, it can believe it is an indeterminate unit. There is in Gentile a typically romantic aversion against determination, against thinking in a really systematic way that deduces the particular and the individual from the universality of the concept. So Gentile turns Hegel articulation, triadic articulation into universality, particularity, individuality, into the dichotomy between thinking thought and thought of, actual will, will wanted. And the result is that both terms of this dichotomy are indeterminate in itself, because the thinking subject is purely universal, and the object thought of is the multiplicity of historical fact. Thus, the moment of the particularity of the concept is done away with completely, and thus Gentile lacks the rational criterion for applying his absolute principle to the determinacy of historical fact. And this is just that Kantian position which Hegel stigmatized in his Phenomenology of Spirit, in his critique of Gesetzprüfung der Vernunft. That is, Kant lacks a determinate criterion for applying the moral law to the singular decision, and thus what the decision is attributed to the arbitrary of the individual. Lacking this criterion for applying the universal to the individual, the application is entrusted to the subjectivity of the individual. And thus Mussolini is just a right example of a political man, because it must not follow determinate ethical political principle. What he does is always right, because it is impossible rationally to deduce verbindlich ethical principle in order to apply the universal to the particular. So space is given to historical facticity, to arbitrariness, and this is just the reason why he found no difficulty in complying with the political guideline of fascism and to become the philosopher of fascism. In my opinion, this reform of Hegelian dialectic is the weakest aspect of his whole conception. I have criticized it from many viewpoint, starting from his critique of the first logical triad, being, nothing, becoming, that in my opinion fails because it doesn't understand the complexity of Hegel's speculative conception, and through his refusal of the possibility in principle of the philosophy of the nature, I just advance an objection against this aspect, and so on. So my reply is there is just a link between his theoretical philosophy and his political rationalism, and this link is to be seen in his reform of Hegelian dialectic, reducing the determinacy, or the self-determinacy of the concept to an abstract universality that lacks any possibility to be applied in an objectively valid way to ethical decision. Second point, Husserl and Gentile. This is quite interesting because I have, in my philosophical career, I have just started not from Hegel, but from Husserl. From Husserl I have come to Hegel. And I agree with you that when one speaks, for instance, his Ideen, published in 1913, Ideen zu einer reinen Ästhetsbuch, where Husserl speaks of the pure consciousness, of absolute consciousness, of the transcendental reduction to absolute consciousness, etc., it seems just that it follows the same direction of Fichte and then Gentile. But there is a huge difference. Is that one must not confuse as, when we have to interpret, to construe Husserl's phenomenological thought. This transcendental dimension that is very only an occasional, a very external aspect of his theoretical work, and his very phenomenological method and phenomenological doctrine, which was already set out in a most complete way in his logical investigation in 1901. And if you all, I think, know this very influential book, Logische Untersuchung by Husserl, and already in this book he set out his phenomenological method that is quite opposite to any speculative idealism, because in this method Husserl stated just his critique of the concept of a pure consciousness. This is contradiction. In the logical investigation, Husserl denied explicitly the possibility of a pure I. Whereas in the ideas and then in his subsequent work, he come back, he had the second thought. Another important aspect is that all idealistic philosophy, speculative philosophy, is grounded on the acceptance of the ontological argument. There is the absolute is that entity whose concept implies existence. This from Spinoza and to Hegel and to Gentile himself, who wrote a new demonstration of God's existence, just a new version of the ontological argument. Where in the logical investigation, you speak only in one very small context of this argument, but only to reject is as completely unacceptable. And this, so his phenomenological method is a method of intuitive vision of essences as an analytic description of ideal objects is oriented in a direction that is quite opposite to any idealistic conception. And as a consequence, also to Gentile's conception. There is only his conception of pure consciousness that seems to constitute a bridge between these two conceptions. And there is a tradition of interpretation of Gentile's thought in Italy, whose main representative was Antimo Negri, who insisted just on the similarity of these two approaches. I must confess that my interpretation is quite different, even opposed, and for me, Husserl and Gentile are to be positive on quite a different, if not even opposed, line of development of contemporary philosophical thought. Well, the third question could be, in a few words...
I said only two questions, that's fine. I asked only two questions.
About feeling.
No, how he reacted to Kohenism, how he reacted to Cohen's aesthetics, for example. What you said about his aesthetics is reminiscent of Hermann Cohen's aesthetic, which is also based on a theory of pure feeling. How did he react to Neo-Kantianism? Did he study, for example, Neo-Kantians? Did he study Husserl? Or was he only influenced by classical German philosophy and ignored the early 20th century German philosophy?
It is a typical shortcoming of his the philosophical conception, which I have tried to set out in the remaining part of my paper. One must acknowledge that Husserl was not interested at all in the history of contemporary European thought outside Italy. This is just another contrast to this nationalistic approach. Gentili devoted 22 volumes to the reconstruction of the history of Italian philosophy. But in my opinion, he never read Fichte seriously, and he speaks of Fichte only so very occasionally or in the indirect quotation, and this has surprised me, because in my opinion, from some point, Gentile is more akin to Fichte than to Hegel. Or is it Hegelian, then that comes back to Fichte and some immediate knowing of the Romantic school. This is. But one must acknowledge that he had no interest at all for any expression of contemporary philosophy besides Marx. Marx was the last author taken into consideration by him, and he wrote radically destructive critique of Marxism. In this book, it was his second book. This was only 24 or 25 years old. And it's nice, it's very careful. He said, after all, I am interested in Marxism only because if people study Marxism, there is the hope that they will once again become Hegelian to Marx. To Hegel. But his thought is a radical form of idealism, of spiritualism, and this thought finds no counterpart in the materialistic conception of man and society as set out by Marxism. And as far as the problem of pure feeling in Neukantianism, in Hermann Cohen's aesthetics, and in Gentile, I have found no reference to Neukantianism. But, for instance, when Gentile writes in the last chapter of his philosophy of art a sort of history of aesthetics, he starts from the Greek conception, from Plato, and ends with Francesco de Sanctis, who for him was the last great aesthetician after Hegel. So the line was Hegel, de Sanctis, Gentile. Croce was the monster, the person that ever misconstrued Francesco de Sanctis' literary criticism. But there is only a very few passages in this last chapter of his philosophy of art, in which Gentile explicitly extols, praises to the skies, the romantic aesthetic. He makes no definite names. He speaks only in general. But he shows a great appreciation and agreement with the romantic conception of art as pure feeling. He says there were many great minds that share this conception that I have tried to set out in a more systematic philosophical way. There is an explicit acknowledgement of the importance of the romantic aesthetics.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you to you for being so patient. Mr. Thank you.
Absolutely.